Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Daniel Kaplan. I represent the appellant Dushan Lamont Broyles. Mr. Broyles admitted at an admit-deny hearing in his revocation proceeding to three grade C violations of his supervised release conditions. These four violations, were of two types: small-scale personal drug use and technical violations, such as leaving the district to appear in front of the judge who sentenced him and failing to report to the probation officer. The guidelines, Chapter 7, recommended sentence for grade C violations by a category criminal history of 3 is 5 to 11 months. This was Mr. Broyles' first revocation of a supervised release. However, despite the guidelines' recommendation of 5 to 11 months, the judge sentenced Mr. Broyles to 3 years of incarceration. In effect, when you look at the Chapter 7 recommendation, the judge turned the structure of Chapter 7 upside down and sentenced grade C violations as if they were grade A violations. Now, in the case of Gall v. United States, the U.S. Supreme Court stated several times that although they rejected any kind of rigid mathematical framework and they rejected any requirement that so-called extraordinary circumstances be present to depart from the guidelines range, nevertheless, it was perfectly appropriate and necessary for this court and other circuit courts on reviewing a sentencing decision to consider the extent of a deviation from the guidelines recommendations. And now after Booker, of course, Chapter 7 recommendations are advisory in the same sense as the rest of the guidelines are. And to consider whether the extent of the deviation is supported by what they called sufficient justifications or significant justifications, with the level of sufficiency, the level of significance, somehow being proportional to the degree of the variance. Well, the degree of the variance here is, of course, extremely high. As I said, the court essentially turned the Chapter 7 structure upside down and sentenced the bottom as if it were the top, more than tripling the recommended range. So the question this court must address in reviewing that sentencing decision is, what are the justifications for departing to that extent that are so sufficient, that are so significant, that they justify such an extreme departure? And when you look at the reasoning that the district judge gave for this sentencing determination, you don't see any justifications of any particular significance. What you see is very run-of-the-mill reasons for revoking supervised release, reasons for imposing that sentence.
Well, perhaps I'm mistaken, but it struck me in reading this that the district judge was reacting to the testimony and recommendation of the probation office and saying, look, he's incapable of making it on supervised release. We've had it with this guy. I mean, that seems to be although the district judge didn't articulate that as particularly as a reason, it looked to me as though his supervisor had just thrown up her hands and said, I've had it. Why isn't that enough?
Well, Your Honor, that's enough to justify what's called a terminal disposition, where there's no further supervised release after the incarceration. But that's not the question presented in this appeal. The question is, why 3 years of incarceration? We understand, and in fact, Mr. Boyle's trial attorney said in that hearing, Your Honor, we can't deny supervision does not seem to be working for Mr. Broyles. But he said, but a sentence to the extent the probation officer is recommending here, the probation officer recommended 5 years, it's way out of proportion to the violations of supervised release. Why that degree of incarceration? What you've said makes perfect sense.
Okay. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. He had numerous violations. It wasn't just one, right?
Yes, he admitted to 4.
Right. And one of them was violating the law.
One of them was what?
Violating the law. Didn't he get arrested?
There was a marijuana possession.
Right.
There was use of marijuana on a particular date. There was a failure to report to the probation office. That's what I call it's a technical violation. And there was leaving the district without permission, which another technical violation. He did that because he thought he would prefer to appear in front of the judge in New Mexico who sentenced him, obviously ill-advised, not consistent with the conditions.
You think just leaving the district is a technical violation?
Yes, because it's not illegal in and of itself. It's only a violation of the terms of his. That's what I mean by technical violation.
Pretty serious violation, though. I mean, from a district court perspective, somebody leaving the district against the orders of the judge when they're being supervised in the district is simply not a technical violation. Showing up an hour late for an appointment is a technical violation.
Okay, I won't fight you in how it's described. I do think that that's not a freestanding criminal violation, albeit it's serious.
I have to say that I would wholly agree with you that a variance, and I don't think this was a departure, but a variance from the guideline range up to 3 years is not a minimal variance. But in this case, was this his first problem?
He had problems before, but no revocations before.
Right, but he'd been given chances before. That's the point. And each time he'd been given a chance, what had happened? He had violated the trust of the court. And I think that Judge Thomas is exactly right. Whether that's sufficient or not, I don't know. But I think he was exactly right in saying that what happened is that this gentleman came before him again with an obvious serious drug problem. And the judge said, you know, it's time for him to be inside and get some serious in-patient treatment where we know he ain't going to leave the district and he isn't going to wander around, he isn't going to get any more drugs. I mean, that's what it looks like to me. It's just that simple. I don't think he was trying to be punitive here.
Well, Your Honor, I'd say a couple of things to that. The judge didn't incorporate the treatment concept into the sentence that he imposed. It was simply a term of incarceration. Treatment had been something Mr. Burrells had tried, and apparently that hadn't succeeded for him.
He's going to get any. I can promise you that any district judge knows that if they send somebody to a jail for 3 years, the BOP is going to automatically put them in drug treatment if they come in for drugs. That's a guaranteed. It used to not be, but it is today.
Okay. That certainly was not expressed in the judge's rationale. But another thing I want to say is the decision for the court in the Simtob case, which Your Honor authored, has a very thorough explanation of what it is that would justify more severe sentencing and revocation of supervised release. And something that is stressed in the Simtob decision is that if the violation shows a carrying through of the same types of offense that underlay the initial sentence that led to the imposition of supervised release, it shows that there's a need perhaps for a greater sentence for the permissible purposes of deterrence, protection of the public, and that sort of thing. Now, in this case, Mr. Broyles was initially sentenced for having 58.5 grams of cocaine, apparently for the purpose of sale, and he pled to possession with intent to distribute cocaine. The offenses that he admitted to in this revocation proceeding don't dovetail with that offense that led to the initial imposition of supervised release. It's small-scale, street-level, personal consumption drug use, marijuana, and marijuana that he said might have had some cocaine on it. He didn't admit that he ever purchased cocaine. So really, we're talking about some small-scale minor use here, not something that shows such a firm pattern connecting to his initial sentencing that led to supervised release that under the reasoning of the Simtob case would justify his
high
sentence.
The time that he'd been released until the time that there were revocation proceedings, how much time had elapsed?
I think it was a couple of years, Your Honor.
And had there been any notifications by his probation officer to the court about minor violations that they weren't going to do anything about, you know, they weren't going to...
The probation officer mentioned in the hearing having written some memos to the judge about problems with Mr. Broyles not always cooperating. But he did for periods of time have clean urine tests and was obviously not using drugs. And as I said, what he admitted to here is not any dealing in drugs, not any possession of any large amount of drugs, just minor personal use.
And it seemed to be the sense that supervised release ought to be terminated. Is that correct?
Yes, and again, the trial attorney admitted it probably should be terminated. It wasn't working for him. Really, what we're left with is why this extreme term of incarceration, what justifies that? Under the reasoning of the Simtob case, it doesn't fit. Those rationales don't fit these facts to impose an extreme sentence and triple the guidelines range and turn the framework of Chapter 7 upside down. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. You're from the government.
Thank you. named his friend or half brother in the United States in this manner. And the issue in this case is whether the district court imposed a reasonable sentence. Under the facts and circumstances of the case that we're facing the district court, the sentence was certainly reasonable.
Well, how do you distinguish this case from the ordinary case you see where somebody violates, has a bad urine sample and is using drugs? I mean, although there were some indications of violence and the fact that this guy's an addict and keeps repeating, it didn't really distinguish itself from a lot of cases we see. And there's a threefold increase in over the guidelines.
Well, there are a couple of answers to that, Your Honor. And the first thing I would know, that really what we're arguing over here is of 12 months, because the district court imposed a 36-month sentence, and on page 11 of the excerpt of record, the defense attorney said that perhaps 24 months would be.
I remember seeing that. He was asking for, the defense attorney himself suggested 24 months and then the termination of supervised release.
No more, yeah.
Isn't that right?
Yes.
So really, he just went up another year.
Yes. So that is what we're dealing with.
Yeah. Well, a year is a substantial amount of time.
Certainly, it is, Your Honor, but when you look at the nature of this defendant and what he had done, it was certainly reasonable for a district court to believe that 3 years rather than 2 years was appropriate.
Well, would you point to those factors that you think show that this was a reasonable sentence?
Sure. First, as you know, on pages 14, 15, and 18 of the excerpt of record, the district court identified five reasons for its sentence. It said that the defendant was unable and willing to follow an army trust. He cannot maintain a drug-free lifestyle. He involved himself in the criminal element. He had a lot of police contacts. He engaged in violent behavior. And what the government believes is the most significant is that the judge found that supervision would not be fruitful. The defendant said himself at sentencing that the probation officer had nothing to offer him.
Well, what's the explanation in the record for not accepting the defense recommendation of 24 months versus 36?
In the probation report, Your Honor, the acts of the defendant are detailed. The defendant engaged in a verbal altercation with the probation officer. He tested positive for marijuana beginning on July 22nd, 2005. He failed relapse treatment. He stayed clean until May of 2007, but the Phoenix Police Department called the probation department because of some in a high traffic drug area. He was indicted for an offense in Santa Cruz County, Arizona. He was arrested but not charged with domestic violence. He was involved in a hit-and-run collision. He didn't inform his probation officer of his police contacts. When he was arrested. He tried to kick the window out of the patrol car.
He hadn't been sentenced for that violation that he pled guilty to in state court, correct?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
That was pending at the time of this.
Yes.
At the time of the revocation proceeding.
Yes, it was. But what we have...
Do you think the district court judge here, you know, sort of just added a little extra punishment here?
No, Your Honor. I know that the district court did in this case is that look at the facts and the circumstances of...
That's about violence.
Yes.
And violent behavior. That suggested to me that he was sort of, you know, adding a little extra time for this guy's conduct.
But,
which is not the primary factor you're supposed to consider in revocation proceedings.
But what the district court did is it looked at the gestalt of the circumstances, and it disagreed with the government, which had asked for a 5-year term. The probation office, which had the most contact with the defendant, asked for 5 years as well. The district court, in effect, cut the defendant a break. What we have here is merely a difference between what the judge imposed and what the defense attorney agreed would be appropriate of 12 months.
Do you think it's appropriate to look at the extent of the deviation from the guideline recommendation?
Your Honor, I apologize for not having the case law at the tip of my fingers, but in other cases I have dealt with that issue, and I believe that the circuit courts have held that an extreme deviation does not need to be justified by extreme facts. The test is whether the sentence is substantively reasonable. And
I'm still trying to figure out what that means for a couple of years now. I'm still trying to understand what our role in sentencing is.
And that concern that you have, Judge, highlights why it's very problematic.
There really is no role for us in this, and we just let the district court judges do whatever they think is right. End of story.
That's certainly not true, Your Honor.
Do we have any case where we have reversed a sentence for unreasonableness since Gall or any of those?
Couple unpublished.
Yes, there is, Your Honor. And Walking Line, I believe, is the case of 5-4-3, 5-4-6. That, however, was the case where the district court judge was unduly lenient, and that the government appealed and was successful. This court does indeed have a role in ensuring that a sentence is reasonable. But in this case, under these facts, Given that the defendant is not amenable to supervision, the fact that he has continued to have contacts and drug activity, and given that the defense attorney conceded that 2 years would be appropriate, it is certainly reasonable for the district court to believe that 3 and not 2 years was appropriate. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Kaplan.
The government suggests that we're really only arguing about a year here and that the district court, quote, cut the defendant a break. The underlying premise is this court needs must surrender its own review to the decisions and the recommendations of the probation officer and to the arguments made by defense counsel.
Well, one of the things that we have to look at is to make sure that the district court, in imposing a sentence, imposed a reasoned sentence, having carefully considered the 3553 factors. That's mandatory, right?
Right.
Both under the Supreme Court law and under Ninth Circuit precedent.
Correct.
In the cases, right? So
right.
That's what we have to do. And you've essentially conceded that the district court explained its sentence adequately. You haven't argued that the district court did not explain its sentence.
That's correct.
So you're really only arguing reasonableness. Now, the district court could have imposed a five-year sentence, right? That was what was recommended.
Could have, not in the sense that it would be reasonable, but...
No, I'm not suggesting. I'm not suggesting for a moment that it would be reasonable. I'm just saying that they legally could have done
that. That was the stat max.
And that was what was recommended. So the district court did not do that, did not follow the probation officer's recommendation. Doesn't that give an indication that the district court was not inflamed to the extent that the judge just simply shot off a sentence in anger against somebody, but rather did some careful reflection, even though the sentence may be higher than what you'd hope for?
Yes, but I don't see any reference in this court's case law or the Supreme Court's case law to the notion that that's what the purpose of this court's review is, to determine whether
the judge
was
blamed. What is the standard of review? Isn't it abuse of discretion?
For a decision that's substantive in nature, it's abuse of discretion.
And you've already conceded that the judge followed the proper procedures. So the sentence is substantive. So all we're looking at is adequacy.
Is correct.
Okay.
Let me return to a question that Judge Paez posed. Do you think our review is any different if there is a substantial difference between the guideline range and the sentence imposed, whether up or down?
Yes.
And what do you think the nature of our review is?
I think the review is might
post-call.
Be described. Sorry?
Post-call.
Post-call, the review might be described as more searching. In my mind, there's an analogy to cases in the equal protection area or in the fundamental rights area of constitutional law where fundamental right is burdened, or equal protection where a suspect classification is at issue. There's a higher level of scrutiny and more compelling justifications are required. I think it's analogous to that context, or the First Amendment context where political speech is burdened. I think that this court must require somewhat more compelling, stronger justifications for a sentence that goes farther outside the guidelines range without falling into extraordinary circumstances or rigid mathematical formulas.
So what, as an approximation, when do you think this additional scrutiny ought to kick in?
Well, line drawing is what's prohibited by the Supreme Court, but some kind of assessment is what's required. So it gets touchy, but when you're more than tripling and you're turning the framework upside down so the bottom level C is sentenced as a top level A, I think this court is required under Gall to require especially compelling justifications. It can't just be run-of-the-mill, everyday supervised release violations, which is all we have here. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is heard will be submitted.